Colin McCann. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And it's great to have you here in person. After 30-odd years in New York, does it still feel like coming home when you come to Dublin?
The funny thing is, when I'm home in Dublin, I'm going home to New York. When I'm in New York, I'm going home to Dublin. So I'm like a man of two countries.
Yeah. And were you? It was your birthday yesterday. Were you home for?
I was home to see my mother in Dean's Grange, who is still going very strong at the tender age. Well, I'm not allowed to tell you how old she is, but she'll be getting a letter from the president in about a year or so.
Right, so and still flying.
Oh,
yeah?
She's fantastic, Sally. Yeah. Sally is the down in Dean's Grange, and still getting up and walking around and looking after herself and living on her own. Fantastic.
Excellent, excellent. I saw you say once roughly that you had to go away to kind of understand here properly. Are you still trying to understand here?
Yeah, I think I'll always be trying to understand here. I think we're always trying to understand where we come from. And I think in a way, we sort of wound ourselves, in leaving the country as an immigrant. Yeah. It there's almost a form of wounding in order to remember where it is that you come from, and also to appreciate it in a certain way. So you can look at the wound and sort of see, should I have gone? Should I not have gone? I'm very happy that I left, but I'm also really happy to come back all the time.
Yeah. Okay. So you've picked out five songs that have meant something special to you throughout your life. And the first song, I think, is related to home, specifically your mum and dad. So home was Dean's Grange. And the writer's curse, a happy childhood, yeah?
Yeah, I had a happy childhood. That is a curse for the writer. But, you know, my mum's from Derry. My dad's from Dublin. They met in London, of all places. And then they got married in Egypt. It's an incredible love story because he had joined the Air Force for a short while, the British Air Force, and
right.
She went out to Port Said on a boat to meet him. They got married in Egypt, and then they came back to England. But I was the first of the family, a family of five, to be born in Dublin. So the house in Dean's Grange, where Sally is now, is the house where I was born and born, bred and buttered.
Yeah, so were you in your old childhood bedroom last night?
Here? Yeah.
Have you reverted a little bit?
Look, I remember like being there, and such a tiny room, but I was in there with my brother and all the posters on the wall, yeah, and the Gordon Banks posters, and I was a big soccer fan because my father was a football player who actually played for Charlton Athletic, and so he was a goalkeeper. So I grew up on goalkeepers, and for my sins, I became a Stoke City fan, which is a terrible curse that I've been carrying for a long time.
Okay, so you had a happy childhood. You thought, I need a cross to bear. So
that's right.
On Stoke. So your father's a fascinating character. So he's in the Air Force and a footballer then, and then became a newspaper man back when a newspaper man was a newspaper man. Yeah.
Oh, I remember going into the Irish Press. He was features editor of the Evening Press. But I remember going into the Irish Press and as a young kid and walking around and all the great big, rolling drums and the printers, and then into the newsroom with Con Houlihan there and Ben Kiley in my father's office and all this literary energy that was there, and the great big sentence of the Liffey rolling past the window. Really good, interesting times to be in the newspaper business. And my dad was very good. He encouraged a lot of young writers, and in particular, he encouraged young female writers, and he had this page every Thursday only for Irish women writers. And there were so many who
That was the women's page that your father had.
Guess what it was called? This is almost embarrassing. Yeah. It was called Petticoat Panel. But, you know, they were doing cutting edge stuff. Edna O'Brien, June Considine, people like this were all writing. Maeve Binchy. It was an extraordinary collection of voices coming together. And so Dad started that back in the late 60s, early 70s. And there were always then writers coming out to the house, and always an energy of, always a literary energy around when I was growing up.
And listen, there's an absolute movie and all of that. Yeah. So why have you chosen then Hoagie Carmichael, Up a Lazy River?
Because he liked it.
Yeah.
My dad liked this song. And you know, they would have parties at home. And I remember being upstairs, 7, 8 years old, listening to them singing downstairs. And one of the songs that my dad would sing late at night would be, say, New Year's Eve or something, that have all the friends over. And he would sing this song, Hoagie Carmichael.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is Colin McCann's first choice today, Hoagy Carmichael, Up a Lazy River.
Up the lazy river by the old mill run, that lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree, throw away your troubles, dream a dream with me. Up the lazy river where the robin's song awakes a bright new morning, you can loaf along. Blue skies up above, everyone's in love. Up that lazy river, how happy you can be. Up that lazy river with me.
Isn't that the sound of a Sunday afternoon in Dublin, funnily enough? Like, but Hoagy Carmichael, Up a Lazy River, that's Colin McCann's first choice, and bringing him back to the songs his father used to sing. So I think your next song relates to your Jack Kerouac period. Yeah. How old were you when you went and cycled across America?
So I started with the newspapers here when I was quite young. In fact, I used to cycle my bike around out to Bray and from Dean's Grange and up around Workman's Club and Tech. I used to report on the matches when I was 12 years old, believe it or not. And then I got into the papers when I was 17, and went to the College of Commerce, Rap Mines, did the journalism course. But I left at the tender age of 21 when I had a page in the Irish Press, and I thought, well, I want to go.
Hang on. What was the page?
Oh, it was terrible. It was awful. It was called The Bottom Line, and I did like little gossipy things for, you know, that were going on around town, and bits of pieces of music and. But it was don't check it out. It was really awful.
Okay.
But that's the thing about the internet now. You can probably find everything that's there.
So you were the hip young gunslinger in the press.
I was, you know. But then I took off and I went to the United States, and I was going to sit down over summer and write a novel. But I didn't know what a novel was. And in fact, I bought a typewriter and I bought a roll of paper a la Kerouac.
Oh, yeah.
And fed it in. At the end of the summer, I had about a foot and a half of gibberish because the A key wasn't working and the E key wasn't working either. And I looked at myself and said, okay.
I think the trick with Kerouac as well was amphetamines, wasn't it?
That's well, that was it. Yeah. He was able to go and go and go and go and go. And I wasn't on the amphetamines, but I had a sort of spirit that wanted to be, like I was very curious about everything. And I thought, okay, do I go back with my head between my legs but no novel, you know, or do I do something else? And I ended up taking a bicycle across the United States for the next year and a half, almost 2 years, did about 12,000 kilometers, 8,000 miles, starting in Boston, down to Florida, across to New Orleans, into Mexico, back up all the way up to Canada and down to the Golden Gate Bridge, San Francisco. A change.
It was an extraordinary thing to do back then, was it?
I didn't think so, but it is now. Now that I think about it, I think everybody should do something that doesn't compute in their lives. There were times, honestly, there were roads in Wyoming where there were like 157 miles between towns. And that's a long way on a bicycle. And I thought to myself, what am I doing? I have no insurance. I have no job. I'm out here. Nobody knows where I am. And yet now when I look back on it, I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but it was the most formative time of my life, Brendan.
Why?
I mean, because I learned how to listen to people. I didn't know it at the time, but I was listening constantly. People come up to me, they'd look at me and they see my bicycle, pannier bags on the back, tent, sleeping bag, and they say, where are you going? What are you doing? But within 5 minutes, they were telling me their life story as if they wanted to give it to me because they knew that it was going down the road. In a sort of weird, vicarious way, they were becoming novelists of sort.
Yeah.
And I would listen to people. And I also, I like the world. I loved listening to all sorts of different. So it could, I didn't care how wealthy they were, how poor they were, what sort of background they came from, you know, what race or gender. It didn't really matter. It was always fascinating to me to meet all these different types of people.
Yeah, because I suppose as a writer, you are very engaged with the world. People think of writers sitting up in an ivory tower going right into themselves and finding stories. But I think Kurt Vonnegut said, no, the writer has to be a social person. You have to be in the world. And
although Emily Dickinson wouldn't say so. I mean, I don't think there's any one prescribed way to say that a writer should or shouldn't
be.
As for me, you know, I want to be in the world. I want to write stuff that's engaged and, you know, maybe political, you know, talking about, you know, what matters, how storytelling matters, how our lives matter, all these sort of things. But, you know, you can be from the Emily Dickinson school as well, and you can hide away and you can write yourself a novel about a rose or a cup of tea. Yeah. And that's going to be fine, too.
Yeah. And you literally really think storytelling can save the world, really,
yeah,
don't you?
I do, actually. Yeah. I mean, people say that the world is held together with atoms, molecules and muons and gluons. But I actually think when you really examine it, that we're the shortest distance between us as human beings is a story. And when you begin to tell someone's story or listen to someone else's story, you begin to knit the world together in a more powerful way, in a more empathetic way. So we're not just looking at our phones. We're not just living our lives within the 4 feet around us. And it's important to remember that everybody else's story matters in a profoundly personal way. Like, I'm not talking about stories that try to win an argument, because we can all do that. But I mean, a story that breaks your heart. A story about your mother going out to, you know, Egypt and getting married. A story about, you know, something that happened to you this morning, or something that we see unfolding in front of our eyes. That's where storytelling really matters.
Yeah, and it's like you call it storytelling, but even from the cycle, right, it's clear that there are two parties to a story, and clearly you're a storyteller,
yeah,
but you as much a listener as well.
Right.
That's the basis of like narrative for your yes, organization.
Yeah.
Is people not just telling each other their stories, but listening as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and telling it back in the first person. So you and I would get together, and then we would go back in a group, and I would say, "Hi, my name is Brendan, and when I was 9 years old," and something happens to the mind when you're telling somebody else's story. It's that great empathetic leap that releases all this dopamine in your brain. So when you tell your own story, the brain is a circus. But when you tell somebody else's story, the brain is like 10 carnivals occurring all at once.
Wow.
You're accessing memory, imagination, retelling. And so this organization, when we're headquartered in Ireland, down in Limerick, and now, believe it or not, we're in almost 50% of Irish schools. And the teachers, by the way, are my heroes, because they're the ones who bring the program together for all the young people. But we find that it works in incredible ways. And we just had a survey done, which says that it decreases polarization. This sort of storytelling decreases polarization, brings people together, and knits us in this profound way that we haven't really been conscious of for a long time.
Wow, yeah. Because, of course, you're embodying the other person's story as well. It's literally, it's in your body then.
You should see what happens in the schools. It's amazing.
Is it?
Oh, it's amazing.
Okay, I must see that sometime. So then, why song number two, Ray Charles, Hit the Road, Jack?
I Hit the Road, Jack, because that's what I did. Yeah. Again, it relates to my dad, and he liked the song. But Hit the Road, Jack, Don't You Come Back No More, No More. And Kerouac was a hero. He was a literary hero. I've got lots of new literary heroes. But at the time, he was the one who inspired me to get on the bicycle and go.
Okay.
Oh, woman, I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right, hit the road, Jack.
That's Ray Charles, Hit the Road, Jack. These are excellent song choices, Colin McCann. They really are.
Thank you.
So listen, we were talking about the you as a novelist who's engaged with the world and everything. The book that changed everything for you, kind of career-wise, and I presume your life as well, was Let the Great World Spin in 2009,
right.
Which you might have intended it in a way, I think, but came to be regarded as one of the great literary responses to 9/11, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, I actually knew it was a 9/11 novel. The day 9/11 happened, I was in New York. The towers came down. My father-in-law was in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. And I remember my daughter, eventually he got out of and she gave him a hug. And she thought, oh, Poppy is burning. And I said, no, he's fine, love. It's just there was a fire downtown and what you're smelling is smoke off his clothes, which wasn't true. But she was like 3 years old at this stage. And then she said to me, no, but you don't understand, Dad. Poppy is burning from the inside out. And I went walking that day around Manhattan and the whole city was stunned. You know, there were lines for the blood banks, but nobody needed blood anymore. And there were still restaurants open. I watched a woman actually eat a chocolate cake. But the thing I remembered the most was reading a Paul Auster essay where Philippe Petit had walked across the World Trade Center towers, quarter of a mile in the sky, in this most extraordinary act of art. And I remember thinking, but he'll never be able to, that nobody will ever be able to do it again. But it's enshrined in art. And I tucked it away in my back pocket for about 4 years and then began to write the book, Let the Great World Spin, which never directly mentions 9/11, but really is all about 9/11.
You have specific music you like to listen to as you write, which brings us to your next song. Tell us about that.
Oh, well, you know, I listened to music early on in my career. I used to listen to a lot of Van Morrison and David Gray. But in the last 10 years or so, my favourite musician is our very own Colm McInerney, who is one of the great fiddle players in the world. People will know him from the band The Frames. And I, when I was writing my last couple of novels, I would put his album And Now the Weather, Anois an Aimseartha, because we would know that from the RTE news. His father used to read the give us the weather, and I would put the album on auto loop, so that it actually became part of the silence, and it was really very beautiful. And then I got to meet Colm. He is one of my heroes, and I travelled with him. We've travelled to South Africa together. We've travelled to the States together. We travelled to the West Bank and Israel together too. And this is where he got inspiration for music that the song that we're going to hear and music that he's working on right now. I just think he's one of the most talented musicians that we have.
You must be profoundly depressed by what's happening in the Middle East this weekend.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about what's going on, there's always a line that comes to my mind. It's from the Muwalakwat, which is these series of 6th century pre-Islamic poems that were hung in the marketplaces in Baghdad, Damascus, all over the Middle East centuries ago. And the line was, is there any hope that this desolation can bring us solace? And right now, because we're so close to it and you see what's unfolding right now, you can't find any solace in any of that. Eventually, one would hope that we might, but it's devastating, absolutely devastating what's happening. And I spent a lot of time there, and I have a lot of friends there, and I think about them, and I've been WhatsApping and calling them and seeing how everybody happens to be. It's devastating.
Okay, here's Colin McNamara, and this is the Minbar of Saladin.
Yeah, this is, can I just explain about the Minbar?
Yeah, please.
Because I sometimes mispronounce it as the minibar, and it's not the minibar. A minbar is a pulpit, and the pulpit is in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, and it's 16,000 pieces of wood interlocking without a single nail or a piece of glue. It's one of the most extraordinary pieces of human architecture that has ever been made, art and architecture. It was burned in 1968. They couldn't figure out how to replicate it until 20 years later. They went, go figure, to the mountain, to the forests of Iran, and found a carpenter who had the secret to how they could put this huge 6-meter pulpit back together again. And now its replica sits in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I think it's a beautiful metaphor for how we interlock with one another.
Okay, here's Colin McCann's third choice. This is Colin McNamara, the Minbar of Saladin. Magic, and I think that's actually unreleased, isn't
unreleased.
It? So far,
yeah,
Colin McNamara, the Minbar of Saladin. They talk about the Arab street. You can hear the Arab street in there, can't you?
Absolutely. You can feel the pulse of the market. You can feel the people roaming around. You can feel the stories. You can feel the dance, the dakba inside it all. Somehow, Colin was able to fuse, this beautiful Irish tradition that he has, and access, sort of an imaginative access to elsewhere. Because we went there together with Narrative 4, and we were broken hearted at what was unfolding in front of our eyes. We went around the West Bank, we went around Israel, and Colin wanted to find a way to access some of the joy that's there, because you can feel the joy and you feel the tension. And I'm very proud to think that I'd even be part of a song like that.
Absolutely. Your next choice is by Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor also plays into this. This song, Nothing Compares to You, was the song that Rami Elhanan's daughter was listening to when she was killed in Israel. I should explain that I wrote a novel called A Paragon. The two characters, one is Israeli, one is Palestinian. Rami is the Israeli. And when I watched...
And real people, just to...
They're real people.
Explain.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's a novel, they're real people. I watched Sinead on RTE on the Late Late Show a few years ago, and she wore her hijab and she sang this song. And I thought, what an extraordinary conjunction of things. Here she is taking this song that's written by Prince, coming out of Minnesota. She understands it. She's Irish and she gets it. She sings it better than anybody else. Yeah. But the child in Jerusalem is listening to it, and it brings all these people together. And I just feel, we're lucky in Ireland. We have a reach. I don't think a whole lot of countries have the same reach, same imaginative reach that you can get to America, that you can get to the Middle East, that you can get to, say, the African soul. I don't know what it is about, who we are or how we listen or how maybe we don't listen, I think Sinead she was tapping into the musical gods when she was creating this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hurt souls are a worldwide phenomenon, really, aren't they?
Right.
Okay, here's Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You.
It's been 7 you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. Eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, I said nothing can take away this blues. 'Cause nothing compares, nothing compares to you.
That's Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You, and that's Colin McCann's fourth choice today. It's strange how songs that are you've heard so much that they sometimes lose their meaning, and then you put it into a context as you just did, and suddenly you feel it all over again. Mm-hmm. So listen, your final song, Amsterdam,
yeah.
I think this relates to the book you're working on now. Are you writing the great Irish novel?
No, not the great Irish novel. One would wish, I wish I could write the great Irish novel. I think it's been done several times before me. I'm actually writing, for the first time in my life, I'm writing about myself. And so I had a, I haven't really talked about this, but I had a brain surgery last October. I had a thing called trigeminal neuralgia for about 15 months previously. And trigeminal neuralgia is where a nerve gets caught in your brain and you get these extraordinarily devastating electric headaches that bring you to your knees. And then I was on all these drugs, oxcarbazepine, carbamazepine, all these different things. And somebody had to go in with their what I call their celestial chopsticks, okay. to untangle the nerve from an artery in my brain. They did it last October. I'm so lucky.
Brain surgery is never straightforward.
Never straightforward.
Not.
Never straightforward. And then afterwards, I ended up going to Morocco, which I probably shouldn't have done. But I got a viral meningitis, post-operative viral meningitis in Morocco, running around Marrakesh with a 104 degree temperature. So I want to write about this, and I'm going to write a book. I think it's tentatively called Brainstorm, because there was a real storm in my brain. But when I first started writing it, and I've only been able to write post the operation, so in the past couple of months, I was listening.
So did
to
the whole did that whole process of the operation, everything, does that take it out of you for a while? Like, does it alter you? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It altered me. I mean, I think the medicine altered me more than the operation. Medicine was dulling me. I was like sleeping for 4 or 5 hours a day. Wasn't able to think. Wasn't able to remember people's names. I was just. And the
alternative was like incredible pain, yeah, unbearable pain.
But they call it the suicide disease. That's what the doctors call it. You know, I don't know how anybody could have lived with it a century ago before the medicines were developed. I actually have a funny, sneaky feeling that Jared Manley Hopkins, who had terrible headaches, might have had trigeminal neuralgia, because he had these knockdown headaches that nobody could figure out. And yeah, my life was not mine for quite a while. And so when I decided to write about it, I actually called the file. I didn't know what to call the file because I didn't know what I was going to really talk about. But I ended up talking about my brain, but also about Israel-Palestine, also about my life in New York, also about Ireland. By the way, I went down and visited a headache stone in Westmeath for Saint Aid is the patron saint of headaches.
Yeah,
and I went and put my head again. This is last October before the surgery. I put my head against the headache stone, and for 5 days I didn't have a single headache. Really? Believe it or not. Yeah. But I think...
The mind is a powerful thing.
The mind is a super powerful thing.
And myth, but is a powerful
messy
thing.
Messy thing too, you know. Yeah. Can you believe it? 86
Are you back?
Billion neurons.
Are you back 100%?
Yeah. Yeah. Back 100%. Yes. I think so. I mean, you'd have to talk to my friends about that. But
was it? Do you think it was connected at all? Like about 10 years ago, you had a very violent, you were a victim of a very violent assault.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It could have been genetic. It could have been just that I was, that they don't know. And this is the amazing thing. They don't, we don't know so much about the brain. And you know, we talk about AI, which is modeled in many ways on the brain with all these different neurons meeting each other. The little we know about AI is pales in comparison to the little we know about how our brains operate.
Yeah, and our consciousness and who we are and where we are. Very, very glad to have you back. So why this song, Amsterdam?
So when I started writing the thing, I was listening to Gregory Alan Isakov, who's another pal of mine. And this song is one of his most gorgeous songs. And there's a line in it about churches and trains. Well, they all look the same to me now. They shoot you someplace while we ache to come home somehow. And I thought, oh, that's so gorgeous, because I am talking about coming home. In a way, it is. You're right. It is going to be an Irish novel. I don't know if it'll be a great Irish novel. One would hope that it would be. But I do always ache to come home. I'm always happy to be home. So I called the file Churches and Trains. And then I said, it has to be the last song that I played today. I just think it's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Yeah, it is. your most recent novel, Twist, has just come out in paperback. A column I think about Twist at least once a day these days. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic book and says so much about our world. But we end today on your fifth and final song. This is Gregory Alan Isakov and Amsterdam. Colin McCann, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
RTE.ie.